Welcome to this Harvard Business School Working Knowledge podcast. I'm Jim Eisner, the school's Director of Media Relations. The American economy is in the midst of the Great Recession, and major financial institutions are in a free fall. Citigroup stock was recently selling for under $2 a share. Bank of America was going for under $3. The Securities and Exchange Commission is taking it on the chin for years of lax enforcement, as the New York Times recently put it. To help us understand how we got into this very big mess, my guest today is Professor David Moss, whose research focuses on economic policy, and in particular, the government's role as a risk manager. He has recently written a draft report on regulatory reform for the TARP Congressional Oversight Panel. And out of that effort has come his most recent working paper, An Ounce of Prevention, The Power of Public Risk Management in Stabilizing the Financial System. Sounds like just what the doctor ordered. David, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Jim.
David, in your working paper, you write that, and I'm quoting here, the current financial catastrophe was not an accident, but rather a mistake, driven by a deregulatory mindset that took 50 years of post-New Deal financial stability for granted. To set the scene a bit, what was the regulatory mindset brought about by the New Deal?
So I think that mindset was to focus our regulatory energy on systemic threats. And the biggest systemic threat at that time were commercial banks. And so they focused very carefully on that. And then they tried to have a rather light touch on the rest of the financial system. So let me just give a little bit of background. If you go back to the very beginning of the Republic, the 1790s, ever since then, from the 1790s up to the 1930s, we had financial panics, major financial panics, on a regular basis, every 15 to 20 years, typically. And this was a recurring feature of American life. This was something that was very familiar and very unfortunate. It was quite debilitating. And the biggest crisis came in 1933. But again, it wasn't the only one. They had come just about every 15 or 20 years. And 1933 closed all of the nation's banks. It was so severe. And so it was at that point that federal officials in the Roosevelt administration and Congress decided they had to do something. And so they passed the Glass-Steagall Act, which we could talk about, created deposit insurance and bank regulation and separated commercial from investment banking, and Securities and Exchange Act the next year. And what you see is that from that point forward, from 1933 forward, there were no more panics. The panic stopped, as you said. And so we had 50 years of financial calm, the longest stretch by far in the country's history. So that was really quite extraordinary. And as I just tried to suggest, I think the reason for that was that they focused on the banks. The banks posed the biggest systemic threat, that is, the threat to the whole financial system, because a failure of one bank could lead to failures in other banks. So they focused on trying to solve that problem. We can talk about it if you want. And from there, they actually were relatively gentle about regulation in the securities markets, in other markets. And so what you see is a financial system that's fairly heavily regulated in banking, but lightly regulated elsewhere. And so we had both stability and enormous dynamism. The United States financial system was the envy of the world through most of the 20th century. Things changed starting in the 1980s, but for about 50 years, we had just an extraordinary period of high growth, financial stability, and financial dynamism as well.
But these regulations, when they were passed, were not accepted by everyone with joy, as I understand it from reading your paper. There was some feeling that this would, again, create this atmosphere of excessive risk-taking or moral hazard, if you will. And nonetheless, it worked.
Yeah, so it did seem to work. There was a lot of concern when we enacted deposit insurance. Again, that was back in 1933, that would lead depositors not to be careful about what banks they chose. And so, in fact, they might go put their money in the riskiest banks because the riskiest banks would be willing to offer the highest interest rates. And so there was a fear what you said, moral hazard. There was a fear that if we put in deposit insurance, the riskiest banks would attract all the funds and we'd have more and more losses, not fewer. But what was part of the genius of Glass-Steagall, of that deposit insurance legislation, was that it didn't just give us deposit insurance. It gave us simultaneously bank supervision, federal bank supervision. So this is very important to pair. If you're ever going to have insurance or guarantees, you also simultaneously have to have a way to manage the moral hazard, the excessive risk-taking. And we did that, actually, very, very effectively. So today we have a new concern, though. We're handing out implicit guarantees left and right, in fact, over $10 trillion in implicit guarantees, or explicit in some cases, over the last year. We're not dealing yet with the moral hazard. We better get to that pretty soon, I think.
We'll talk about that a bit later. Now, you mentioned that in the early 1980s, something happened to derail this long period of calm that you've described. What was going on there in the 1980s?
So I think that we came to take this financial stability for granted. So, again, 50 years is a long time, and people began to think, well, it's just natural not to have banking crises and not to have bank failures. And so we started to see the costs of regulation and took the benefits for granted. And in the paper, I say it's a little bit like if we, you know, through public health measures, we've eliminated most epidemics. And what if we started to take that for granted and say, well, epidemics just can't hit us anymore, so we don't need these public health measures. We don't need vaccinations and so on. Well, we pay a very heavy price. And I think that that's essentially what happened. The deregulation by itself maybe wasn't a problem, but in the context of insured banks and savings and loans, it was a problem. And exactly the type of moral hazard that critics warned about in the 1930s ended up hitting us in the 1980s because we removed that regulation, or at least limited it. We reduced that regulation that controlled the moral hazard while simultaneously not only maintaining the insurance, we actually increased it in the same legislation. And so with insurance and less control of the moral hazard, what we ended up was excessive risk-taking, just as the critics had warned, except they warned about it 50 years before. And the risk-taking in the savings and loans was particularly acute, and we saw these large failures and over $100 billion in bailout that was required. So the mistake, I think, was forgetting about this important pairing. If you're going to have insurance for the stability, you need to have some reasonable degree of regulation to control the moral hazard, to control that excessive risk-taking. And I think we in a sense, forgot that lesson in the early 1980s.
But what seems to be happening now is that we're in the age of the bailout, and the very big bailout. What's your analysis of that approach?
Well, let me step back just a minute. I think some of those bailouts may be necessary at this moment. But there's a question of how we got into this. And I think that what happened is we remained in a deregulatory mindset. The savings and loan crisis came and went, and we had to re-regulate in that area. But we continued to see, and I think many cases appropriately, that regulation has high costs, and it does have high costs. But what happened is as the financial system evolved, and so you see in the 1930s, it was commercial banks that posed the biggest systemic threat. Beginning in the 1990s, you see the growth of broker-dealers, investment banks, in a way that we had not seen before, as the size of their balance sheets increased dramatically as they began trading more and more on their own account. That made them systemic threats, or they could pose a systemic risk to the economy. But not only had we not regulated them very aggressively, we actually, if anything, probably deregulated them in the last few years, beginning in 2004. And so as a result, we had this new large systemic threat, and we weren't regulating it. So if we were to apply the New Deal logic, we should have looked very carefully at those broker-dealers. We didn't. And so when the subprime shock hit, these institutions were far too leveraged. They had taken far too much risk. And as they began to collapse, that posed huge systemic threats to the rest of the financial system. And so I think that, in a sense, was the problem. And now as we look at it, we need to focus on those systemically significant institutions, if I can use that phrase, as we move forward.
And can I segue now into the one possibility that some of these banks may be so far over the cliff that they have to become nationalized to be saved?
Right. So I think people find nationalization a frightening word, and it's probably an inappropriate word because I don't think anyone is talking about having the government take over and maintain control of banks. When any institution goes into bankruptcy, it essentially goes into a receivership where the judge and the trustees temporarily operate the institution. And what you see in time is that, and not such a very long time, is that the creditors become the shareholders. That's what normally happens in bankruptcy. And that's, I think, what needs to happen perhaps with some of these institutions as well. But the one issue is with a financial institution, it probably has to happen on an expedited time schedule. So it's not clear that we have the luxury of going into Chapter 11 and allowing it to work itself out. What we saw with Lehman is that can be a disruptive process. So I think if we try to expedite that process with a government receiver, not nationalization, but a government receiver that will take control in it for a very temporary period in order to be able to expedite the transfer from the shareholders to the creditors. Again, that's what we do in Chapter 11. It's a very typical. That's what I think we need to do here, and probably the best model is FDIC. So for a commercial bank, when a commercial bank fails, and you've probably noticed when IndyMac failed, for example, it closed on a Friday, it was reopened on a Monday, almost no one even noticed. And what the FDIC did is they temporarily take over the institution, and then you're going to see this transfer. They're either going to sell it outright or move it over to the creditors. Creditors are going to lose something. Creditors other than depositors are going to lose something in the bargain. That's the risk creditors take when they finance an institution. But it's that transition that I think that we need to talk about. So right now where we are is that the government doesn't want to allow these institutions, some of the very biggest, to end up in Chapter 11. And so as a result, they're willing to put in more and more and more resources to prevent them from failing, the so-called too big to fail. My own view is at some point that becomes a mistake, that becomes too big a problem, and we need at some point to allow the creditors to take the loss and move the ownership of the firm from the shareholders to the creditors. I'm not sure exactly when that point comes, but at some point that'll have to be. There can't be really an unlimited guarantee from the federal government.
Yeah, as you just sort of indicated, there's a certain amount of catch-up going on here, dealing with issues as they get worse, it seems. But in your paper, you describe what you regard as a kind of cure to how this might be handled going forward. Can you outline for us your prescription as to how this should be handled in the future?
So, cure might be a little strong, I have some ideas, right? And so, and the paper is called An Ounce of Prevention, and the focus really is on prevention. So, again, I would say the broad problem that we have is that before 1933, we had a lot of systemic threats that we weren't managing very well, and every 15 to 20 years, the financial system fell into crisis. In 1933, we focused on the most dangerous systemic threat, the commercial banks. We managed it very, very well. I should say they managed it very, very well, and we had the stability. What we've now seen is the rise of a new systemic threat. So the question is, do we regulate the entire financial system from top to bottom? Do we not regulate it at all? Or what I would propose is we focused, as we did in 1933, we focus on the systemically significant institutions. That is, those institutions that if they failed, whether it was a Bear Stearns or a Lehman or others, if they failed, would they cause great damage to the rest of the financial system and the rest of the economy? So I might run a little company, and if my company fails, it'd be unfortunate for me, but it wouldn't affect too many other people, maybe, sadly, the employees who work there. But if a big financial institution like Bear Stearns, the reason we didn't want to let that fail, if that failed, that could cause enormous damage throughout the economy. So my view is we need to identify, not at the midnight hour, just before they're ready to fail, we need to identify in normal times which institutions pose systemic threats and which don't. And once we do that, then it seems to me those are the institutions we should regulate more stringently to try to prevent them from taking on excessive leverage and excessive risk and off-balance sheet liabilities that are hard to see, contingent liabilities that are hard to quantify. And so if we can identify and regulate those institutions in advance, it seems to me we can leave most of the rest of the financial system to be vibrant and dynamic, which is the trademark of our financial system in the past. So I would focus there. Another advantage of doing that is that when a financial institution realizes they're going to be regulated more heavily if they become systemic, they may have an interest in not becoming systemic. Right now, it's just the opposite. Institutions see these large implicit guarantees, the too-big-to-fail phenomenon. They want to get big. They want to get big. They want to be systemic because that means they're going to have free support from the federal government. We can change that. We can make it more advantageous for them to try to be less systemic or smaller. And I think that'll give us a more robust and more vigorous financial system.
As I understand it, this regulatory body, and you're proposing a new regulatory body to do this, would also include hedge funds, which has been an issue that's been on the table now for quite a while from the SEC on down. Is all this realistic as opposed to being academic? Do you think that, in fact, we can create a new efficient bureaucracy to do this kind of thing?
Well, a bureaucracy is never going to be perfectly efficient, but we have to look at what we've already done. We've already guaranteed almost the entire financial system. That's a very, very dangerous thing to do. The moral hazard that is now involved is enormous. And so the question is, how do we want to deal with it? Do we want to deal with it before the fact, before a crisis hits, or do we want to wait for crises to occur and keep putting down the money? It seems to me that, like in 1933, we've now created the insurance, whether we like it or not. The implicit guarantees and many, many explicit guarantees are there. Now we need to think about how do we control the moral hazard. I think the only way to do that is to identify these institutions. Now, you mentioned hedge funds. I think most hedge funds would not be systemically significant. That is, it'd be unfortunate if a hedge fund failed, and we're going to see some failures. We already have seen a few. They're not, in most cases, going to cause broad trouble to the financial system, and we can let them fail. And we don't need to any special regulation. We'll need to collect some information because we need to know whether they, in fact, are systemic. So some may be so large or so deeply interconnected in the economy, in the financial system, that they would come under this definition of systemically significant. Then I would want to regulate them, just like I'd want to regulate, a very large broker-dealer. But for the most part, I would say most hedge funds wouldn't fall under that. In fact, most financial institutions, the vast majority, would not fall under this definition of systemically significant. They really, what I hope is, they can go about their business and be as innovative as they ever had before. It's the very, very large ones that, if they fail, could cause such damage to the economy. Those are the ones we have to watch carefully.
Finally, you mentioned this concept of a federal insurance for these firms. There's no such thing, if you will, as a free lunch. How would that work?
So this is maybe the thing I've worried most about, and I've been thinking about. We've put on these enormous guarantees, as I said, now in excess of $10 trillion. That's a lot of money. And no one has really a good idea about how do you get rid of an implicit guarantee. So you can say, well, it's not there anymore. The government can deny its existence. But we denied the existence of the implicit guarantees on Fannie and Freddie. And, of course, when they failed, there was the government bailing them out, even though it had promised that it wouldn't. We often promise that we're not going to bail out in the aftermath of a natural disaster a community that has been bailed out several times before. But when the crisis hits, it's very hard to watch a community injured in that way and not to do anything. And so, in fact, we go in and help. We always do. And so it's almost impossible to get rid of an implicit guarantee. And so as a result, I've looked back historically, how do we deal with this? And strangely, I think the only way to really get rid of it is to make it explicit and to limit it. So instead of denying its existence and then, of course, waiting for the crisis and then it's really there, even though you said it wasn't, and everybody knows it's there, the alternative is to make it very explicit, to regulate the institutions that are covered, and to limit the guarantee ex ante in advance very, very, very carefully. And so I'm proposing a type of what you might call capital insurance, where the capital of the institutions could be insured by the federal government. It's a little bit like TARP, except it would all be defined in advance. The institutions that are affected would pay premiums, so they wouldn't get anything for free at the end, and that the guarantee would not be just for weak institutions. It would occur if there was some systemic event or crisis. All systemically significant institutions would get a payout, the same payout, to help bolster their capital. And if beyond that an institution still failed, then we'd have to let it go. And I would favor an FDIC-style receivership. So what I'm proposing, no institution would be too big to fail. In a crisis, we'd try to have a capital injection from the government, which would then be withdrawn after the crisis. That insurance, if you will, would be paid for by the firms themselves, like federal deposit insurance. But at the end of the day, if a firm failed anyway, I don't think we should be supporting it. I think we should be putting it into an FDIC-style receivership, like IndyMac did the bank. We have to use that for non-banks as well. Again, no institution should be too big to fail. In guarantees, if they're going to exist, I prefer that they not exist. But if they exist, they should be explicit, not implicit, and they should be carefully defined and limited and paid for in advance. So that's what I'm trying to propose. It's a little ironic that the best way to deal with an implicit guarantee is to make it explicit, but sometimes when you sort of fool yourself and say it's not there, that can be the most damaging thing of all.
You know, on your various trips to Washington, have you been able to sort of sow the seeds of these ideas with legislatures of one house or another? What's been the reaction?
So there's been surprising interest, really, just in the last few weeks. There's been surprising interest in this. Who knows how it's going to end? There is a clear recognition that we need some kind of systemic regulator. And the question is exactly what that regulator would do. My view is that we should have a bright line separating systemically significant institutions from those that are not. And the reason why I think that is at the end of the day, either the government supports such an institution or it doesn't. So I think there is a bright line. Ultimately, we might as well define it in advance. But there are others who have great insight into this, who suggest maybe we should have more of a sliding scale. That's perhaps a reasonable proposal. Others say we should be regulating activities, not institutions. So there are a number of ideas out there. This is one of them. It's been getting some attention. But we'll see how it works out. Hopefully, together we can find a good solution to deal with these systemic threats. We certainly don't want to go through this again.
Well, I'm glad you're thinking hard about this. We need that sort of thing. Thanks again for coming in and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you.